Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here with a kind of cool announcement. You may have noticed that the Lawfare podcast has been running increasingly frequently, that we are having a whole lot of new content from a wild diversity of people. Well, today we are making it official. The Lawfare podcast is, from here on in, daily, at least 5 days a week. We will be changing our schedule to run Monday through Friday, at least on work days. And that means that our normal Saturday episode will shift back to Friday. We are institutionalizing Disinformation Thursday. The Arbiters of Truth series will become, at least through the end of the campaign, a permanent feature of Lawfare. And we will have more stuff from me, from David Priest, from Margaret Taylor, from Scott Anderson, from Quinta Jurassic. So bring us in every day. One other thing about this, it's expensive to do it. And so, you know, we've made a point of not asking for contributions during COVID-19. But if you value what we're doing and you want to support the Lawfare podcast, go to the Lawfare support page and make a monthly contribution or a one-time contribution. This is a big lift for us, and we're excited to do it, and we hope you are excited to listen.
Protesters were chanting, "Hong Kong people, build a nation." That's a direct appeal for independence from Beijing, and that is not something that the Communist Party is obviously going to be happy with. Hundreds of arrests also today. So the fact that this national security law, it will be quote-unquote voted in by China's rubber stamp parliament tomorrow on Thursday in the afternoon, and will be promulgated likely fairly soon after that by the chief executive of Hong Kong. It's entirely possible that demonstrators being arrested now could be charged under that law, and even that risk is not enough to keep them off the streets.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast. May 27th, 2020, Hong Kong protesters are out in the streets once again as the Beijing legislature contemplates a new national security law for the city, and the Hong Kong legislature considers a bill to make it a crime to disrespect the Chinese national anthem. It's all going relatively unnoticed amidst the international focus on the coronavirus, but Hong Kong is increasingly under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. To discuss the latest developments, joining us from Beijing is Sophia Yan of the Daily Telegraph and, of course, Lawfare's official pianist. You're hearing her play right now. And Alvin Chung, who is originally from Hong Kong and is affiliated with the U.S. Asian Law Institute at NYU. We talked about the details of what these laws would do. We talked about the way Beijing might use them to crack down on dissent. And we talked about what the protesters hope to achieve in this latest round of street violence. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 27th, Hong Kong erupts. Okay, Sophia, let's start with just an overview of what's happened over the last few days in Hong Kong while the world's attention has been focused on masks and other things.
Well, protesters in Hong Kong have come back out in the streets. Unrest has been ignited because of two legislative changes that are underway. One comes from Beijing, and it is to impose a national security law in Hong Kong that would criminalize secession, separatism, terrorism, foreign interference. And this is just being put in place by the central government, bypassing the Hong Kong legislature. The other proposal that's in place is one that's been put in by Hong Kong lawmakers, which would criminalize any sort of insult to the Chinese national anthem. Both of these have sent protesters back out in the streets despite social distancing rules because of the coronavirus pandemic. There's a lot of worry that these proposals will completely erase the rights and freedoms that Hong Kong has long enjoyed.
Alvin, walk us through the substance of these two laws and how
they would change the status quo in Hong Kong. The status quo in Hong Kong is so hard for people to understand in its relationship to China that I think a lot of people, including me, by the way, don't really understand to what extent this would functionally change things or would merely symbolically assert China's de facto authority or de jure authority. So just explain to us what the laws would do and how much change they would really mean.
All right. So first, let's talk about the threatened legislation from Beijing, from the National People's Congress, which is the Chinese rubber stamp legislature. In addition to the categories of activity Sophia's listed, there's one more that has just been added within the last day or two, which is acts that seriously endanger national security. Now, we know from reading the mainland's own national security law from a few years ago that the PRC has an extremely broad conception of national security. And it encompasses everything from protecting borders and punishing subversion by foreign influences to guarding against and resisting negative cultural influences, quote unquote. So that's already a pretty long list. Perhaps most significantly in terms of tangible consequences, the NPC's legislation would give legal authority to mainland state security to operate in Hong Kong. We know from the abductions of Li Bo, the bookseller, in circa 2015, if I remember correctly, and Xiao Jianhua a few years later, that mainland state security has already been operating covertly in Hong Kong. If they are given official legal permission to do so, we can expect much more widespread activity of this sort.
So, Sophia, maybe this is for both of you. How much of the reaction to this is a reaction to those real world consequences, and how much of it is a sort of reaction to the symbolism of Beijing once again using its authority, sort of asserting its authority over Hong Kong? Do you think the people who are turning out in the streets now are responding to that real world change, or are they responding to, you know, in a kind of a, I don't, Hong Kong nationalist way to the assertion of power by Beijing?
Well, the putting this national security law in completely overrides what China had signed on to in this joint declaration, the Sino-British joint declaration, which kicked in after Hong Kong was returned by the British Empire to mainland Chinese rule. And that was meant to guarantee rights and freedoms in the territory that you don't see in mainland China. So there's always been a fear amongst Hong Kong people that the kind of murky legal and judicial system that mainland China operates with would come over to Hong Kong. And there have been a lot of cases over the last few years where bits and pieces of that have come through. I mean, there have been, as Alvin mentioned, booksellers who were squirreled away. They were kidnapped outside of mainland China and somehow reappeared, giving these forced confessions on state television. I mean, there have been a lot of cases like that of mainland Chinese authorities acting beyond the mainland China border, impacting Hong Kong people. So that worry has always been there. And putting in this law essentially will legalize all that kind of behavior. This was part of the worry over the extradition proposal last year, which is what kicked off the mass protests. Then those protests died down with the virus. But again, they're just starting up again because there's so much worry about what could happen. And this particular national security law, it will be nearly impossible to walk back. The act of Beijing putting this law, just imposing it onto Hong Kong, completely bypassing the legislature. I mean, this is something that just goes against the idea of one country, two systems. It is not allowing the city legislature to make its own laws. And this is a huge encroachment on what normally would happen in Hong Kong. There's a huge fear of things like I mentioned the forced confession, but there's just a real worry that this will pave the way for officials to squash dissent under the guise of quote-unquote national security. I mean, in China, the authorities purposefully use the very opaque system here to disappear people that they don't like, dissidents, their black jails. I mean, people just fall off the face of the earth for years without warning or explanation. And so it's that particular concern that a system like that would be in place in Hong Kong. And of course, this then throws into question whether or not Hong Kong would, for instance, lose its allure as a global financial center. And it's clearly a risk that Beijing is very ready and willing to take so that it can bring Hong Kong under control. I mean, definitely Beijing sees Hong Kong as a territory, a wayward territory that hasn't behaved itself.
Alvin, talk to us about the national anthem law, which, as I understand it, is being considered by the Hong Kong local legislature and would criminalize disrespect to the Chinese national anthem. What is behind that, and what does the Chinese national anthem signify to Hong Kong peoples? Why is this becoming a flashpoint now?
The genesis of the National Anthem Bill was a series of sporting events where the PRC National Anthem was booed by Hong Kong spectators. And what it heralds is really the imposition of the sort of performative acts of loyalty to the PRC that a lot of Hong Kong people associate with, in particular the post-1989 period in mainland China. There was some discussion early on in the legislative process of applying that law retroactively, which is frankly an extraordinary suggestion. And it really is the latest step in what amounts to the creation of a lèse majesté regime. There are already offences that prohibit desecration of the national and Hong Kong SAR flags. So in that sense, the anthem legislation simply takes things a step further.
And how widespread is the, like, if you had a sporting event tomorrow, assuming you could do it in a social distancing fashion, and you had no threat of, you know, prosecution for expression of ideas, what percentage of people in Hong Kong, in your estimation, would boo or turn their backs on or, you know, show some defiance of the Chinese national anthem? Is this a small group of people? Is it widespread sentiment? How much does the PRC really have to fear here?
That's a good question. Originally, when the issue first came up, I would have suspected that the response to the PRC national anthem would have been much less loaded. But as of now, 2020, after months and years of repression, particularly over the past year, I think that even among people who do not actively boo the anthem, there will certainly be a widespread sense of passive resentment.
All right. So, Sophia, talk to us about the new round of protests that have broken out. There seems to be a pretty serious effort on the part of the Hong Kong police to prevent them from forming. They seem to be not huge, but pretty substantial. How do you understand what's happening on the streets right now?
Police seem to be much more prepared than they were when protests first ignited last year. They're stationing in groups, getting ready very far in advance, especially because they know these announcements, the way things have gone lately with the national anthem law and the national security law, because of those developments, the authorities clearly know that protesters are upset. They're also planning still on social media channels, and so the police are very much likely monitoring all of that, trying to stay on top of what protesters are trying to do. There has been a growing faction calling for Hong Kong independence. This started last year and it's coming back again today. Protesters were chanting, "Hong Kong people, build a nation." That's a direct appeal for independence from Beijing. And that is not something that the Communist Party is obviously going to be happy with. Hundreds of arrests also today. So the fact that this national security law, it will be, quote unquote, voted in by China's rubber stamp parliament tomorrow on Thursday in the afternoon and will be promulgated likely fairly soon after that by the chief executive of Hong Kong. It's entirely possible that demonstrators being arrested now could be charged under that law. And even that risk is not enough to keep them off the streets. The sentiment is still very strong. Certainly the numbers are a little bit less. There's public health concern first for a lot of people in Hong Kong. And of course, there's a fear that they might be netted in this sort of no man's land. We're getting into a very murky legal territory. This hasn't really happened before. So what happens next in terms of how this law gets implemented is a big question mark. There's even some talk that foreign judges in Hong Kong won't be allowed to hear these cases once they do go to trial. But even with all this risk, people are still taking to the streets. So it's a sign, really. It just signals how upset people are with Beijing's power over Hong Kong.
And when you say that there's some talk that foreign judges won't be allowed to hear these cases, do you mean that Hong Kong judges? I mean, under this law, who would try? Would these cases involve, I assume they wouldn't involve extradition to China, but how would they proceed? This may be a question for Alvin, not for you, Sophia, but what's the modality of how these cases would happen if and when, or I should say when, the law goes through?
Right. This is really a racial dog whistle more than anything else. The way I suspect that they could implement this in just as a matter of law is to say that only Hong Kong permanent residents with PRC citizenship can hear these cases. What that means in practice is effectively almost entirely judges of Han Chinese descent. We've seen over the last few years a consistent drumbeat from pro-Beijing politicians directed at Hong Kong judges not of ethnic Chinese descent.
And just to be clear, because a lot of people, including me, why are there and how many are there Hong Kong judges who are not Han Chinese, and who are they?
So some of them began their careers in Hong Kong as expatriates. Some of them come from families who've been in Hong Kong since the 19th century.
So they're people who are longtime Hong Kong residents / citizens, but who are by one means or another creatures of residents who grew out of the British presence.
In large part, yes. And then there's the Court of Final Appeal, which has non-permanent judges taken from other common law jurisdictions. And what was particularly interesting about this is that there have been calls on and off for this system to be abolished. And most recently, the appointments of Baroness Hale of Richmond of the UK and former Canadian Chief Justice McLaughlin were opposed by pro-Beijing politicians. And in some cases, explicitly on the basis that quote-unquote foreign judges could not be trusted with matters of importance to Hong Kong or the PRC.
Like, spin this out 3 weeks from now, there are protests and this law is in effect. What do you expect will happen to a protester under a kind of maximalist reading of the law?
I think the better question, assuming that the threatened legislation passes, is what can't happen. It really is the imposition of what Ernst Frankel called a dual state. The vestiges of the common law and the ordinary legal regime will stay in place for people who are not seen as threatening the PRC. And then there will be the prerogative state, which is mainland state security and the black bag brigades and all the rest of it. And they will decide who the normal law applies to.
That's pretty horrifying. Sophia, do you have anything to add to that? Does that sound alarmist to you?
No, I agree with that assessment. Just think about it. This is the nation that was punishing whistleblowers for the coronavirus pandemic. Actually, even now, China is still punishing people who for online speech about the virus, even as the government has been crowing about their success in containing the virus. Yeah, life is getting back to normal for sure in China. But even though the government is talking about its great success and painting itself as a global savior in this pandemic, it's still locking people up whose ideas and comments don't jive with what the Communist Party wants to hear or wants the world to know about. So this is a pretty normal situation in the sense that this happens really all the time. You know, there's a charge that's used a lot to silence activists and dissidents here, and that's picking quarrels, provoking trouble. Under this particular charge, people disappear. And it was always this fear for a lot of Hong Kong people that this kind of system would be put in place. A lot of people say it's not rule of law, but rule by law. And in their eyes, for people in Hong Kong, this is the worst case scenario has happened. And now the question is, well, what happens for them next? Can they go somewhere else? A lot of people I've talked to are talking about trying to find ways to move out of Hong Kong because of these changes that are happening really very quickly. And you have to remember that this idea of national security legislation was one that Hong Kongers had already protested against in 2003, a very similar proposal, also extremely contentious at the time, was actually scrapped after mass protests. Since then, a number of protests have erupted periodically, culminating in the mass unrest we saw last year over the extradition bill before expanding to speak out more broadly on Beijing influence, now going into calls for independence. So the way this has evolved in Hong Kong is something that Beijing really wants to just squash. And it's even spread now to how Beijing is talking about Taiwan. There are lines about how Taiwan should be looking at Hong Kong and realizing that the idea of Taiwan independence is a joke. So clearly the Communist Party is not going to be backing down anytime soon.
And what is your assessment of what the protesters really want? Is the goal here to stop these bills and to maintain the level of autonomy and rule of law-ish that Hong Kong has? Is the goal to vent rage? Or is what we're really seeing this a kind of emergent nationalism and independence movement that actually aspires to genuine independence from Beijing?
I think the demands for independence, at least until very recently, have been a red herring. And I've written about this elsewhere before, but the demands for Hong Kong independence were never within the Hong Kong political mainstream. And it was only ever the Beijing and Hong Kong governments, particularly starting with the then chief executive CY Leung in 2015, that the authorities started to gin up independence as a bogeyman that somehow justified repression. Of course, what has happened since then is that this has, to some extent, become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the conclusion that at least some Hong Kongers are now coming to is that the PRC cannot be trusted in any way, and so the only way out for them is independence. Had the Beijing and Hong Kong governments applied a softer hand to begin with, I don't think we ever would have reached this stage.
Sophia, what do you think?
I would say at the start of protests last year, Hong Kongers, what they wanted was what was guaranteed to them when colonial status, you know, they were sent back to China, which was that they would have rights and freedoms preserved for 50 years until 2047. But now with the way things have gone, China really hasn't let up. And I suppose in some ways, the West in 1997, when Hong Kong was returned, perhaps thought that in nearly two generations' time, that by 2047, China would have opened up and become more liberal, maybe even be something close to a Western-style democracy. That obviously hasn't happened. On the Chinese side, their calculation was that what everybody else thought in 50 years' time just didn't matter because Hong Kong was Chinese again. They could do what they wanted. I mean, you hear this line all the time from Beijing, especially now, about how Hong Kong is an internal Chinese affair and not one for anybody else to talk about, to meddle in, for foreign nations to meddle in. They keep threatening on the Beijing side, quote, countermeasures against the U.S. If the U.S. does anything, the U.S. has been considering possibly pulling Hong Kong's special status, which has helped it become a global financial center, in retaliation for what Beijing's doing with this national security law. So this is not going away. And these calls for independence, I mean, it's a very fairly small-ish faction still at the moment, but the calls are growing and people are becoming less concerned about saying that. And it does seem for many that this is the only way out in the long term if they really want to avoid becoming, quote, another Chinese city. A pro-democracy lawmaker, Claudia Mo, I just spoke with her today, and she was saying that this is, she called what was happening a cultural revolution part two, and that with this national security law, people would start to become very afraid to say what they think. And this is something, again, this is just what it's like for people who think a little bit differently in mainland China. And it's not far-fetched to think that once this law does come into place, that that's the way life will be in Hong Kong.
And you say it's still a relatively small faction that's, you know, openly talking about independence. What is the dominant when you hang out in the protests, which you've done quite a lot of? What is the dominant strain of thought about what they are seeking?
There are growing calls for independence. I think in some ways protesters haven't fully thought out what that would look like. And so while there's a small but growing faction, a lot of them are trying to pressure the UK to do more, to push Beijing into holding up its end of the bargain of the joint declaration. It is an international treaty, and the UK could theoretically make a real fuss about it at the UN, or at least draw more public attention that would embarrass Beijing to a certain extent. China doesn't want attention on this issue. And again, they've always said that this is it's our house, not yours. Don't mess with it. So perhaps doing that would at least put some roadblocks in for Beijing. There's interest also for asylum applications coming from Hong Kongers to be approved in the UK or for other countries to take them in. And there's one particular point of contention. It's long been an issue, which is something that came in near the end of colonial rule in Hong Kong, British national overseas status. And this gives holders consular assistance and a travel document. It's like a passport, but it doesn't give anyone who has it the right to abode in the UK. So there are growing calls for the UK to extend greater rights, the right to live and work in the UK for those who have this BNO status. There's a lot of debate about whether or not that would be a good idea. There was always concern from the UK side. It seems that doing that would mean a bunch of Hong Kongers would flee to their country. And whether or not that happens, we'll have to see, I suppose. But this particular debate has been ongoing for a very long time. And now, because of the way things have gone, there's a real question as to whether or not international pressure or attention could really redirect the course that Beijing is already on. And so the calls have gone from asking for international attention to asking for ways to help them find a safe haven to go, an option too.
Alvin, I want to get your sense of what the degree of leverage that international actors have here. Beijing is a difficult negotiating partner under any circumstances, and as to what it regards as its sovereign territories, whether Taiwan or Hong Kong, it is completely implacable and doesn't really negotiate. So what, as a realistic matter, can any international actor hope to do here?
That's a good question, particularly under present circumstances when the PRC seems to be much more emboldened in its foreign policy. Part of what can be done is to offer refuge to Hong Kongers, speaking in respect of Canada, where I'm currently sitting. There are 300,000 odd Canadian citizens in Hong Kong. Sophia's already referred to the number of British national overseas passport holders who are also in the territory. Countries should also be looking at Magnitsky-style sanctions against individual Hong Kong and mainland Chinese officials responsible for these policies. But really, the time to do all of this and the time to say something was at latest about 6 years ago. And it's a pretty grim indictment of the international community that all the warning signs have been around for this long and that they've been consistently swept under the carpet until the very end.
I want to ask you about another point of leverage, which may be the only one that the PRC really cares about, which is I don't really see how Hong Kong retains its position as the kind of global or the Asian financial capital that it has been for a very long time. It is kind of New York to the Asian world without some degree of autonomy that is actually meaningful. I don't know what degree that is, but if you can't publish the South China Morning Post, you're in a very different sphere. And I do think that Singapore, which is hardly democratic itself, but is a relatively light touch form of authoritarianism, is very well positioned to take over that role. And so I'm curious what, from your point of view, is it a win for China if they, or the ultimate Pyrrhic victory, if they assert really full control over Hong Kong and they get a depopulated, brain-drained territory, they have full control over it, but you know, half of it moves to Vancouver and a large chunk goes to Britain. And what remains is relatively old and nobody wants to have their headquarters there, their Asian headquarters there anymore. And so, you know, there's a substantial economic migration to, you know, Singapore or somewhere else. Is that a win if that's what happens?
With the Chinese Communist Party, you have to consider what their priorities are right now. And their priority is to stay in power. And that is the overarching number one thing on their to-do list. And nothing else gets in the way. So trying to bring Hong Kong under its thumb even more definitely outweighs the risks. The risks, as you delineate, are certainly there. But also at the same time, other cities like Shanghai and Shenzhen have developed a lot over the last 30 years. Shanghai, in many ways, could rival Hong Kong. Hong Kong has long been a gateway to bridge China with the Western worlds and with its rule of law and freedoms and things like that. I mean, it's always been attractive for business, for multinationals, for investors. But in a way, China's betting that it's worth taking that step because it wants to stay in power. That really governs everything that they do. And a few years ago, when China announced this Greater Bay Plan, Greater Bay Area, which would integrate Hong Kong more, and similar to the Bay Area, really, in California, but to integrate Hong Kong more into southern Chinese cities, that was, in retrospect, maybe the beginning of this idea that Hong Kong would just be subsumed into mainland China.
Alvin, what do you think? If China has full control over the rotting husk that used to be Hong Kong, is that a win or is that, you know, Pyrrhus?
I think there will always be people who are willing to turn a blind eye as long as there is money to be made. So to that extent, Hong Kong will still have value to the PRC, even if it is left a shell of its former self. Will it have nearly as much value? That's a more difficult question to answer. But, you know, the people who are still willing to do business in Hong Kong may insist that everything is all right up until the point that they're bundled in a black bag onto the express train to the mainland. So it may be a victory. In the long run, it may not be the victory they want.
That's a very sobering way to put it. I want to ask about two other models here. One is Macau, right, which, you know, is right next door and under much tighter PRC control, and I think much less successful, although it has a kind of Vegas-y sort of role. What do you guys think Is that a vision of Hong Kong under more direct PRC rule, that it kind of becomes a sort of Hong Kong-like, but also a much, you know, much less important, much less vibrant, and much more, you know, parochial? In Macau's case, it's really a gambling center. Is that the direction that Hong Kong goes if this continues?
There's two things about Macau. One is that Macau, when it was returned in 1999, it was a Portuguese colony. So when it was returned to China, there was an offer for citizenship for anyone who wanted to leave. And so there's always been some thinking that for those who wanted to leave and not return and subsume under Chinese rule, that they did. And so that the population when it in Macau was already sort of self-selecting when it did go back to China. That's one. And then the second thing is Macau's economy has flourished because of this casino industry. That's largely what the economy stands itself up on, tourism, casinos. But also it's where a lot of money laundering goes on, and some of that money laundering affects Chinese officials. So the crackdown, a crackdown on Macau would is not quite the same. Does that make sense? I mean, Macau, it's like a pair, they're mutually beneficial. Let's put it that way.
No, I wasn't suggesting a crackdown in Macau. I was suggesting that sort of Macau today is what we might expect Hong Kong to look like 15 years from now.
It's difficult to say if Hong Kong will end up in as relatively parlous a situation as Macau. There are historical reasons why Macau is under much tighter control today. So in the 1960s, around about the time of the Cultural Revolution, there were communist instigated riots in both Hong Kong and Macau. The riots in Hong Kong were put down, and there are still debates today over police tactics used at the time and the like. In Macau, the riots were much harder to control and led at one point to a suggestion from the Portuguese authorities that the territory be handed back early. So the Portuguese folded much earlier. And so the foundations for more extensive party control have been present in Macau for much, much longer than they have in Hong Kong.
What do you guys, let's close with this, what do you guys expect to see over the next few weeks? The Party Congress is going to pass the national security law tomorrow. What should we be looking for to happen on the ground in Hong Kong when that happens? Sophia?
I think how the authorities go after those who have been arrested, the protesters who have been arrested, and what those trials and cases look like, exactly what they're charged with, if they're charged under this national security law, I think that will tell us quite a bit about how this law will be used and or whether it will be abused. Hong Kong and Chinese officials, including the Hong Kong chief executive, they keep saying that this law is necessary to maintain peace and stability and that those who aren't breaking the law have nothing to fear. Again, the worry has been that the law will mean cracking down under this premise of quote-unquote national security to just get rid of anybody who's got a dissenting view. So how people are pursued as things go on, as time passes, I think will tell us a lot about what kind of rule of law Hong Kong will see in the next few months and few years.
Alvin, what are you looking for starting tomorrow?
I don't think that the threatened legislation will be passed within a matter of days. It will almost certainly be passed within a matter of weeks or months. But at this point, what is happening to Hong Kong is a bit like a bank run, right? Beyond a certain tipping point where people have lost faith in the institutions, it's all over. So in that sense, it almost doesn't matter what the National People's Congress does next, because the widespread assumption, which I think has some merit, is that the law will mean whatever the party wants it to mean.
We're going to leave it there on that awful, cheerless note. Alvin Chung, Sophia Yan, thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey guys, we are daily now, so this is a great time to tweet about the Lawfare podcast, share it on social media, leave us a review saying, I'm so glad you're daily now. Here are 5 stars. This is what I have always, always, always wanted. That's the kind of review we want. We also want you to go to thelawfarestore.com and buy all your Lawfare merch. It's a good time for Lawfare notebooks. It's a good time for Lawfare pens and, of course, the famous Lawfare socks. The Lawfare podcast was recorded by Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. It was produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And, of course, our music was, as ever, performed by our guest, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.